Welcome to Regulating AI Podcast, hosted by Sanjay Puri. Join us each episode as we dive into the evolving world of AI governance with global leaders, exploring how to responsibly tackle AI's challenges while fostering innovation and balance. Welcome to another episode of Regulating AI, where we delve into the complexities of creating fair and equitable regulations for artificial intelligence. Our podcast features insights from various perspectives, from industry leaders and government officials to advocacy groups. Together, they address pivotal questions that are needed to create fair and practical legislation. I'm your host, Sanjay Puri, and today we have the honor of speaking with Dr. Dominique Monzelon, a trailblazer in the field of AI ethics and data science. Dr. Monzelon is the world's first triple doctorate trained physician, data scientist, and AI ethicist with a remarkable background in leveraging AI to address pressing health challenges and inequities. From his groundbreaking work in cardio-oncology to his contributions to the field of poverty alleviation through personalized medicine and public health, his expertise spans across disciplines, making him a leading figure in shaping the ethical and regulatory frameworks surrounding AI. Join us as we explore his insights into the intersection of AI, health equity, and global policy. Welcome, Dominique.
Thank you for having me.
Great. Dominique, our show has a global audience. We have members of Congress, Senate, their staff. We have industry leaders. We have advocacy groups. And as I said, it's really a global audience, North America, Europe, Asia, South America. So having said that, can you share with our audience about your journey that led you to become this triple doctorate trained physician, data scientist, and AI ethicist?
Yes, sir. And again, I appreciate the kind invitation to join you and your influential audience, because we desperately need you. Because I came from a small little 2.5 red light town in a poor rural farming community over in southwest of the U.S. And so I grew up in my mom's clinic. She had, unfortunately, on the first day she began as a nurse, went to go take her state nursing board exam, doing breakfast with grandpa. And she unfortunately clutched his chest, fell to the ground. And because we're in a poor farming town, there's no doctor coming. There's no ambulance right around the corner. So mom jumped on, started doing the chest compressions, trying to bring him back to life, restart the heart that unfortunately had failed. And unfortunately, 15 becomes 20, becomes 30 minutes. And then by the time the ambulance finally arrived, unfortunately, they confirmed that he had already gone. So mom goes on, takes that state exam just a few hours later, scores one of the only perfect scores in the exam's history. And then over the next 20 years, became a nurse practitioner, a doctor of nurse practice, opened up the clinic just 100 yards facing the front door of grandpa's house. And she just did what we weren't able to do for him, namely providing care for an underserved community. And so I grew up in that clinic, and I just wanted to follow mom's lead, be able to give back to the community that raised me. But with all the changes in healthcare, it became increasingly clear that medicine had to change to keep up. And so I had started medical school to try to follow mom's lead and just care for the community, but quickly realized that the changes required a different additional approach. And so that's where I began the first PhD in the AI side of health management with a policy and a global management standpoint. And then that was just a way to keep mom's clinic open. And so using smart AI to allow good people in good communities to get good care for those who need it most. And then that accidentally translated into working with the United Nations, because a lot of the technical side led into a lot of the ethical side, especially when we try to scale innovations from the AI standpoint. And so is a AI responsible? Is it transparent? Is it safe? It's something the community wants and can lead. And so that accidentally led me into the second PhD in the ethics side of that. And so I presented this work ultimately with Microsoft over in Rome back around February 2020, I believe, when they were convening the, as I understand, the first high-level multi-sector consensus on responsible AIs with Microsoft and IBM and the United Nations FAO, and I think the Vatican as well, being able to come together for the Rome Call for Ethics. And so I was surprised that a little guy from a two red light farming town was asked to give his presentation on how to do this kind of integrated work. So I was awarded, surprisingly, the world's, as I understand, top doctoral dissertation on AI ethics, trying to propose how do you take the mathematics, bring it together with the medicine, bring it together with the ethics to ultimately allow communities everywhere to be able to help, like I try to do in my little area, take care of their community.
Well, Dominic, listening to you, I definitely feel absolute underachiever. You've done things that people take multiple lifetimes. So firstly, congratulations on that. And really heartwarming to hear about your growing up in that small town. And, you know, it really gives hope to a lot of those small towns. And I think when we talk about AI, how it is going to revolutionize the availability and access and remove the health equities. But just one quick point, because I've had these discussions with leaders of medical schools and programs on this show. Do you think the way medicine is now being taught needs to change given what technology is there? Shouldn't the curriculum, and I brought this up, and they said that there is a big discussion going on, but you are the epitome of what the new physician should be like. But then you are an exception, but that should not be the case, right?
Excellent points in terms of should education keep up with patient needs. I definitely agree with you. And that's where we're seeing a lot of promise. So, for instance, when I had started medical school, it was shortly after Hurricane Katrina had decimated New Orleans, and we had just unfortunately, hundreds, and we think of thousands of deaths there, particularly in the lower income racial minority communities, good people that just couldn't afford to get out. And so when you have these food deserts and these large expanses of the city that just didn't have access to healthy foods, they didn't have access to affordable doctors. And so I worked with a team as I was working on mom's clinic back home. I was also trying to figure out how to use AI to bring the best of medicine, the best of public health, the best of AI, and the best of education together. So we were very fortunate to accidentally, as we look back, co-found that culinary medicine movement, where we started in an abandoned grocery store, and we brought together a school, we brought together our medical school, a local high school, a local grocery store, and a bunch of community organizations, where the community itself led the way, and they said, we need this, but we want to make sure we don't get lost in the conversation with a bunch of big powers that come in and swoop in and do it their own way. So we tried it at the table together, quite literally the dinner table in our little fledgling teaching kitchen. Ask the community, what do you want? And then they told us, here's what's important to us. And we said, this is what we think we can bring together. How can we do it together? And so I tried to bring that kind of by learning by doing approach, where I would bring in other medical students and then nursing students, medical trainees, and even eventually attending physicians to be able to eventually develop and try to fine tune this model of learning by doing, the way that medical education can adapt in real time. You don't just sit in a classroom and get lectured about organs. You actually talk to people who organs are failing at the dinner table together. So it was teaching the medical students and the medical trainees and attendings how to cook, how to talk nutrition, how to talk it in a way that's relevant, affordable, and impactful for these communities who most need this. And then we were able to then show through a series of randomized controlled trials that I developed in a long-term cohort or a long-term study on this, all driven by the AI to help us understand in real time what works and what doesn't work, and to change quite literally the curriculum in real time to fix it, we were able to improve patients' health, improve their food savings per week at the grocery store, and ultimately improve the competencies of the trainees and the attending physicians in how to do this work well. And what we found very exciting is that we could find that not only can we improve medical education as a supplement, not a replacement to what's happening in the lecture halls and happening in the hospitals, we were able to show that physicians and soon-to-be physicians were much more engaged. They wanted to not just do this work. They wanted to keep improving the medical education themselves so they could see in real time that they can impact this whole process, this whole life cycle of medical education innovation, not just research and clinical care. And then we were able to then scale that to, I believe now, 50 plus medical schools throughout the country. And we have now some that are outside the US as well. And it's very exciting to watch this work continue. So in brief, to your question, yes, I definitely agree that not only is it possible, not only is it doable, but people want this, both the patients, the providers, and the trainees. And we're seeing in conclusion that this is work that increasingly is spreading overseas. If I can mention one last little part to your excellent question. So I also am a professor of bioethics for a couple of United Nations universities, including in Mexico. And so I teach graduate students on really from four continents, particularly Asia, Africa, South America, Eastern Europe. And what we're seeing is that a lot of physicians, a lot of public health researchers, a lot of healthcare administrators, lawyers, just hospital staff want to do this work. But unfortunately, we're seeing that there's an ivory tower syndrome still in the global north, particularly in the US and Europe. We have this legacy holdover where we've got the intellectual property, we've got the exciting tech, we've got the exciting curriculum models coming out, but it's not inclusive enough and therefore innovative and adaptive enough to meet the needs of the global patient population, not just our local communities. So what we're finding out is that through my own little work, trying to be able to learn from the graduate students I teach, these physicians and lawyers, administrators, but to try to be able to provide and propose to them what we found that works and then learn in real time from them. So it's not a unilateral, but it's a bilateral medical education innovation that's happening at a global level, at scale, and with relevant impact on local communities. So I'm very excited about what we're seeing coming out with these global partnerships.
So you talked about global partnerships and community involvement. Mm-hmm. Just one last question before I move. There is a generational divide, which is obviously relevant. You know, you have physicians who've been trained, who have maybe, you know, who grew up pre-internet era, so to speak. And then you have these new, we are looking at one. But now the generation of physicians that is coming in is talking about whether it's the tools of AI, the ethics, mm-hmm. the equity of AI. Is that currently in the course curriculum for them? Is that being taught currently, Dominic? That was the question which I've asked them, and they said they are the powers that we are looking at tweaking the course curriculum. Right. Do you think that should be done, Dominic?
Yes, sir. Because ultimately, medical education should be about patient care. We should be training people who care and know how to care for their local community based upon where their needs are. And so if we're not achieving the outcomes we need to change the process by which we're getting those outcomes. And so we see that patients increasingly, now more than ever in human history, plugged into the global digital ecosystem. And just what the last 48 months, we have a doubling of smartphone users on the planet with some of the fastest uptick in sub-Saharan Africa and Southeast Asia. India, for instance, is a real pioneer in this, being able to, as you probably know well, see how to do digital health ecosystems at the national, local, but also global level as well. Not only because are we learning from people on all sides of the planet, as one innovation works in one area, we can scale it globally, but also we're seeing that we need each other to be able to improve this for mutual benefit. And so to your point, unfortunately, there is a lag, though, between where patients are and where medical education is. And so though we are seeing promising work done, and my hat's off, of course, to all the industrious and intrepid medical school pioneers and educators and leaders who are doing this difficult work of trying to translate, on one hand, the best of evidence-based medicine we can and best of evidence-based medical education, including with the AI piece, into real-time medical education. The challenge is, understandably, there's been a historic, I think we can say, caution, and I think rightly so in healthcare, just because it works in other sectors, we're cautious. We want to make sure we don't mess it up when we translate into patients' lives, because if we make errors and scale those errors, then we're hurting people in real time. It's not simply, though it's important, it's not simply getting a business model wrong, it's getting someone's life wrong. So though I respect those concerns, at the same time, there are ways which we've found that increasingly you can scale medical education in real time effectively, responsive to local community needs and local community identity, but at the same time, learning from the global ecosystem in this regard. So we are seeing, in brief to your question, promising pioneering projects, but no clear long-term sustainable evidence-based standardized approach to doing this work. And that's where, for instance, with my little work in culinary medicine, and increasingly with my work in the bioethics and the AI ethics and the cardio-oncology worlds, we're trying to be able to find areas that are clinically relevant for patient populations and provide that as addendums to supplement and enhance existing curriculum. So that way medical schools have the autonomy and the agency to say, we want this, we don't want that. But by picking up these kind of, in a sense, modular new things, they're able to take with it the entire educational model, that education life cycle of innovation, where people have the students, not just the attendings and the patient communities, that are innovating real time, how to adjust the curriculum. And therefore, you're able to maintain safety and control on the curriculum, but at the same time, responsiveness to the needs of the patients. So we are seeing promise in that as a compromise, a halfway position, getting medical education where it is now and to where it needs to be shortly, hopefully.
I'm hoping some of the decision makers do listen to this, and they'll be listening to your message. Dominic, shifting to ethics, what are some key ethical considerations in your view that should go into integrating AI into healthcare practices?
Ooh, that's a tough one. And so I wrote 4 books now and counting on that. So I'll try to give the condensed version. The short answer is, I think that globally, there is a common understanding of what good care looks like and what good tech-enabled care looks like, that's responsive to the needs of the patients, that's safe, that's effective, that's transparent. We understand how it was made. We understand how it rolls out. We understand who benefits from it, not just the people, the patient at bedside or communities or in the hospital or the clinics, but also the providers doing that, but also all the tech enablers. Who are the companies that are supplying this tech, what they get out of all this, and the educational system behind it, et cetera. The challenge is how to get from where we think it should be to where we are now. So in brief, we do see a lot of promising advances. Like I mentioned with the 2020 Rome call for AI ethics and a consensus emerging within the public and the private sectors about how to translate this, I think we can say, global understanding, regardless of our belief system, regardless of our political economic regimes, regardless of our sectors that we primarily reside in, there's an understanding that people deserve better. But also pragmatically, we need to do better. And so as we saw, for instance, with the Great Recession, we saw with the COVID pandemic, we're seeing with a lot of the both the food and energy crises globally and in really increasingly warming conflicts all over the world, that if we don't help others, then the instability there travels everywhere else. We can't just say we're going to quarantine our country from the disorder or the challenges of everyone else, nor can we say we don't need help outside of our borders to be able to help what's happening inside of our borders. And that's where I think that AI and healthcare provide not only a needed, urgent intersection to improve the lives of patients right now and to ensure that AI can be done responsibly for that, but also provides a paradigm, a template for how other sectors can do it as well. So to your point, the primary ethical challenges, it seems, that are emerging are, how do you scale responsible and inclusive AI globally without losing the local values and identity and agency of the local population you're treating? And toward that, we are seeing promising advances of a lot of consensus developing, for instance, in the American model about trying to have responsible, principled-driven corporations doing this work. We're seeing in Europe, particularly with the EU AI Act emerging, looking at a human rights-based approach of this regulation. And we're also seeing promising advances, for instance, in China and India, in the African Union, about how to be able to reach consensus on politically operational, ethical, cultural values that's responsive to the needs of one's community, but at the same time benefits from the global collaboration. Because ultimately, if we're cutting ourselves off from the global digital ecosystem, not only are we cutting ourselves off from the markets where that tech can get better with, not only are we cutting ourselves off from the innovation exchange, but also we're cutting ourselves off from the needs of humanity. In conclusion on this point, I had a great physician mentor when I was being trained that said that the best medical researchers, first, the best medical practitioners, because if you're not at the bedside listening to what the patient needs, you can't develop better treatments for them. And I think similarly in the responsible AI world for health, if we're not listening to people globally across sectors and belief systems, we don't know how to make the kind of tech that humanity needs.
Dominic, you raised the point about global cooperation several times. There is this point that currently AI is a English Western-driven large language models. The CEO of NVIDIA encouraged every country to create their own model because it would retain culture, history, etc. The two points that come out from you is, should countries have their own large language model? And then in terms of collaboration, because right now there is an AI nationalism that is going on because it's a matter of pride, in some cases, national security. How do you kind of balance what you're talking about, cooperation, especially on health, as you said, listening to others, learning from others because it's a global community? How does one balance all of that?
Excellent question. Very difficultly. And so if I can approach the question from a different angle and then back up into it, an excellent strategic question that I believe that it's incumbent upon our global and governments and institutional leaders and corporate leaders to be able to answer is in parallel from a top-down approach. We need our leaders asking, tackling, and resolving these tough issues with popular consensus. But bottom up, we also need people, the community, engage in these kind of questions. And we see, for instance, in the ChatGPT moment, for instance, where all of a sudden AI was promising and nascent and showing some powerful innovations, but not yet it seemed part of the public consciousness. And then ChatGPT comes out, and all of a sudden we see the power of generative AI. You mentioned the AI nationalism, which seems to be particularly heating up at the end of last year. After the first few months, we see this meteoric rise of like Microsoft with ChatGPT's backing, NVIDIA supplying these high-end AI chips. And you're seeing the efficiency gains of early adopter organizations that are seeing that you can get conservatively 20 to 30% efficiency gains in this kind of work, in a way that is able to respond to the demographic challenges, particularly in the global north, where we just don't have enough skilled labor. And in the global south, where there's a notable skills gap, where unfortunately education is not catching up arguably fast enough to meet the responsive needs of the populations. So ChatGPT therefore becomes this moment where, as you probably saw with the IMF report last year, looking at what over we expect 60% of job impact more in the developed rather than developing world. And not all of it's going to be good. And so there's a great Harvard Business Review that argues that AI won't replace humans, but humans with AI will replace humans without AI. And that becomes not only a pragmatic, not only a political question for stability, an economic question for productivity. More skilled labor equals greater productive national and global economies, but also an ethical challenge. It's not just for some to benefit more than others. That AI therefore becomes simultaneously the greatest power centralizer in human history. Small number of power players control much of where the dominant tech is heading, which therefore controls much of the global digital ecosystem, but also the greatest arguably power decentralizer, where you have not only on one hand the AI nationalism that's developing, corporations and governments trying to wrestle with how can we not get left behind in the AI arms race, but also you have this amazing democratization of AI where people are getting the power in their hands in real time at a faster life cycle of this tech than we've ever had before, going from decades to just a few weeks. So for instance, Microsoft's CEO, Satya, I believe, mentioned, I think a year ago at the World Economic Forum about that example. On one hand, the excitement of ChatGPT about how it's helping drive efficiency gains in the corporate world, but also how an Indian farmer is able to use a version of it on his smartphone in the field to navigate the government assistance required to be able to keep his farm going. So within those two power dynamics, the centralization and the decentralization of AI, to your point, there does seem to be an exciting, also concerning trend where that question is largely irrelevant. Because by the time we come up with a plan and we implement it, the ecosystem's already moved on. So for instance, the great work the EU has done in the AI Act, very impressive, very important, but it was years ago that they already had launched the effort, and it's still not fully, as I understand, ratified, though it definitely is needed. And it's definitely efforts like that should, I think, continue. There is at the same time, corporations, communities, hospitals that are saying, we need to do the work now. The question therefore becomes, how do you reconcile those two? We have to have a good strategy, but also good on the ground realization that people are not going to wait for the regulations to catch up. And so I think that to your point, efforts like yours and the very influential community leader in this regard, from the governments to the institutions to the corporations and the schools, being able to try to promote human-centered strategic design on this that stays, keeps essentially the tech R&D bounded by the guardrails of human dignity and rights in a way that's able to be a common global ethical language, at the same time understands the practical economics that it's going to keep going before you put out your regulations and your legal frameworks, but at the same time providing that democratization of AI as well, where you're trying to empower and inform populations about how this work can be done safely. So therefore, I think by doing both the centralization of AI and the decentralization of AI, it allows the power to be bounded by justice. And I think that's a way that's not only relevant and impactful, but also is urgently needed the world over, regardless of our sector.
So the centralization and the decentralization will potentially assist us, but you made a one point about, you know, the IMF report and others. Mm-hmm. Will physicians with AI replace physicians who don't have AI? Because you just talked about that, because your profession is going to change dramatically too.
Yes, sir. I agree with you. And I think it already is drastically happening. On one hand, we don't know what's going to be the net impact, because on one hand, we have a massive shortage of already of physicians in the U.S. and also in the global north. And we see this concerning trend of the global brain drain, where you have talented and ambitious physicians from the global south, particularly in Africa, and we see in Asia as well, coming to arguably, as it's been described, the global north, the U.S. and Europe in particular, seeking arguably better opportunities, et cetera. Mm-hmm. The challenge, though, is that though urgently needed, those talented individuals here in the global north, they're also desperately needed where they came from as well. And so the argument is, on one hand, what's going to be the net impact if, are we going to have a graying or a population aging in the global north in our workforce, including in the physician workforce, faster than we're going to be able to see the brain drain, or are we going to see efficiency gains in AI so great and a real push from the public and the private sector? We see a lot of this, particularly in the emerging partnerships between big U.S. and European tech companies. And we see also promising regards in India and China as well, trying to be able to take good corporations, pair them with big international institutions and governments, try to form these kinds of decolonized or post-imperialism partnerships where local communities are able to drive the work they need, empowered by these global networks. And thus we have more of a stabilization in the co-capacity evolution in both the North, where we need more workers, and the South, where there's the argument they need more of the tech enablement. And to your point about the physician workforce, we don't yet know where the trends are heading. But what we know now is that right now, we have a desperate shortage of physicians, and that need is only going to grow as we have growing numbers of retirements, of retirees, but more and more healthcare needs that already exceed the capacities of healthcare systems already under strain post-COVID. So we do see not only the ethical argument that good, responsible AI can make care more accessible and affordable for larger populations who need it, but we also see the pragmatic and the economic argument that it needs to be done. Are these hospitals increasingly risk shrinking operating margins that imperil their ability to sustainably care for their communities? So to your point, there's a lot of exciting, I think we can argue, is project or operational level AI advances, looking at how, for instance, you can have mammograms for breast cancer screenings done more effectively by a radiologist that's able to, instead of just read what one radiologist reads, but what happens if you have 10 AI algorithms that are running 10 radiologists worth of algorithm of images. We see already a lot of work in this in Ghana, in Sudan, that's very exciting. So you don't trade efficiency or safety. The reads are still accurate. You still have the human in the loop, the radiologist confirming the reads accurate, but you can drastically increase productivity. But it's not just enough to have those kinds of operational level advances. We need also the strategic level or capacity level advances. And that's where we see promising work, for instance, with Mayo Clinic's platform initiative, or Cleveland Clinic's partnership with IBM and the quantum computer, the first commercialized health computer. We see promising advances with a lot of big systems that are not just saying, how can we do nice AI that sounds good for press releases? I'm not saying that systems are principally driven by that, but how can we make sure it's a strategy-wide, enterprise-wide, mature AI to make sure that both the clinical side but also the operational side of healthcare. Both the medicine and the business side of healthcare are able to both be improved responsibly with an AI cycle that can do the whole thing more effectively and transparently for patient populations to maintain societal trust and patient buy-in, but also do so at a stable and sustainable growing operating margin. And therefore, we do see already rapid advances to your point that it's not so much a displacement or a job replacement. It's a question rather of how can we meet the needs of our patients, which is inherently, and I think necessarily, meaning it's more AI to make up for the less physicians coming in, but it's trying to augment and enhance the care of the patient to touch the hand of a dying patient at bedside where the AI ultimately can't reach. So to know where AI can help, but also know where you still desperately need the human touch.
So augment the capabilities and needs of physicians and patients is what you're saying, Dominic, at an operational and a strategic level. Mm-hmm. Let's delve a little bit into some of your very, very interesting work. The only thing I would say to you is our audience are not all triple doctorates like you, so you might keep your answers given that in mind. We have developed innovative methodologies like BAM, PS, transnational statistics, and AI health mathematical models. Can you explain how these tools are transforming healthcare?
Yes, sure. And so I'm hoping it's transforming healthcare, at least efforts like it are. So I tried with BAM, PS, and a few other methodologies I've tried to propose and develop over the last few years. And I've tried to provide it as much as open access as possible, free of charge to readers globally, by trying to detail the methodologies that essentially are meant to be able to bring the clinical side of healthcare, what works and what does work. Does treatment A work better than treatment B? But also the cost effectiveness. Can you afford as a hospital system to provide treatment A rather than treatment B? But also the cost of the inequities societally about what happens if we don't do that. And you combine all that from an ethical framework. I've developed a framework I've tried to propose as something called the personalist social contract, where mm-hmm. you try to take the world's diverse belief systems as you also therefore are able to therefore identify what are the common substantive values we have and that we share. Namely, can we believe that the patient deserves good care? What does that actually mean at a practical level day to day? And you take that and you develop an ethical framework that's able to be articulated in the language we have that's dominant in both modern AI big tech companies and our global governments, and we hear it a lot with the United Nations as well, that concept of the dignity or the value of the person, irrespective of their power or their societal value, that the person has that value there. And you translate that kind of ethical framework in a way that's able to integrate that full pipeline of decision-making, the same way that, for instance, a physician at bedside, when I walk up to a patient, and most physicians, I believe, we walk up trying to ask, what's wrong? How do we fix it? How can we at least accompany the patient by trying to make their lives better? So we're already, as physicians, trying to be able to combine the clinical, the cost effectiveness, and the ethical side. So what I've tried to do in my methodologies, including with BAM-PS, is to try to be able to digitalize that thought process, to digitalize human dignity in a way that is readable and understandable by the AI algorithms, and in a way that's also profitable and sustainable for healthcare systems to be able to support it. And so that kind of methodology with BAM-PS is one I've used in a number of my recent studies to try to show not only how to advance in specific concrete domains, for instance, with cardio-oncology or patients who have cancer and heart disease, for instance, with a recent publication on cardiac arrest about if a patient's heart stops, how do you restart it and help a patient heal? And better yet, how do you prevent that heart stopping in the first place, like my grandfather mentioned in the beginning of this discussion? So those kind of methodologies are meant to try to be able to not only show how it can help right now those patient populations from cardio-oncology to public health to global health, but also to be able to show the mathematics behind it, to show how it can be applied and adapted and scaled for other research teams and other healthcare systems globally. So BAM-PS was an attempt to be able to try to show that. And my hope, therefore, is that that can be part of the continuing larger story of AI's digital transformation of healthcare, that people don't have to use my algorithm, but I think it has to be something like that, where we bring together not some, but all members of the global ecosystem and the human family.
So from BAM-PS, let's shift to another model that you have come up with. Can you give an overview of your Bayesian machine and deep learning augmented propensity score approach, and how does it advance health equity?
Right. So what it essentially is and how it works, particularly for health inequity, is it's meant to try to be able to ask in real time what works and what doesn't work, but we're significantly limited by the current R&D life cycle in healthcare. Namely, as you're probably, and as are your readers and listeners aware, unfortunately, it takes generally about a decade and about $1 billion to bring a drug to market, and largely most of those fail ultimately. And so we don't have, as we saw, for instance, in the COVID pandemic, you can't say to the world, everyone just pause, stop where you're at. We're going to figure this out over a few years. We're going to come back to you. You have patients that are getting sick right now, patients that are dying right now, and we can't pause people's lives to get evidence-based care to them. And so what that approach was, the Bayesian approach, was a way to be able to combine essentially the best of what we have from a mathematics standpoint. So you take the Bayesian side, which is a way, generally speaking, to be able to understand right now what's the most likely prediction you can make on a given treatment being better than the other treatments based upon everything you've known before. Because most of our medical statistics, most of our research right now is, unfortunately, though helpful, it's about a century old and doesn't work very well. It essentially is a very two-dimensional, very narrow view of statistics. What's happened before? How do you predict what's happening next? But what AI brings to it and what Bayesian analyses bring to it is a much more realistic and accurate understanding of how we are right now. So as a patient, if you're clutching your chest and you realize you may have heart problems, you need to hurry up and get in your car and get to the hospital. But you're not just going to get in your car and just drive straight. You're going to use what you know before how to get to the hospital to adjust in real time your prediction of what's the fastest way to get to the hospital. That's kind of what Bayesian analyses do. You're updating your knowledge of what's happened before to help better predict what's going to happen next. So with my methodology there, with the BAMPS and with the Bayesian analysis you mentioned, that's meant to update the most accurate predictions you can based on what's happened before. But AI helps you do it at a much more complex and real-time scale than what you've had before. Because unfortunately, most of our medical research still runs on a pretty standard, basic way, not just of the old school math, but also the old school computation. You put a bunch of things into a statistical software program like a blender. You turn it on and you get what you can out of it. Mm-hmm. What we need is more of a real-time understanding of what's happening with the complexity of the data and in real time. So rather than trying to make the medical reality essentially condense and conform to the simplistic way of computing and analyzing data, it's meant to be able to let us conform to the reality, to understand, hey, patients, don't stop what you're doing. We will come to you. You won't have to come to us. And so the methodology I developed with the Bayesian analysis is meant to help try to do that. So AI gives you complexity in real time. Bayesian gives you greater arguable accuracy and richness in analysis. And that integrated analysis, otherwise, with bringing the ethics and the cost effectiveness to it, is meant to allow you to translate clinically relevant and cost-efficient results into a way that's economically viable for the decision makers, for the hospitals, but also for taxpayers who largely are going to have to fund this. And to your point about equity, what does all this mean is that as we have an explosion of health equities, about $250 billion a year in the U.S. alone, upwards, we believe about $1 trillion by 2040, we can't afford not to do this kind of work. We can't afford to just say, okay, let's sit around and let our tech get smart enough to where it can run healthcare for us. We need patient answers now. And so what my methodology tries to do with the BAMPS and with those other related methodologies I've proposed is a way to try to be able to essentially take smarter analytics in real time with a greater complexity, understand what works best, and provide therefore the best options to providers, to healthcare leaders, and to publics to allow more informed decision together about how we're going to move forward. And that's where the inequities comes in. You don't have to use it as an add-on analysis at the very end of all this. It's built into the very beginning, because arguably good patient care is going to be good ethical and equitable and efficient care. So you therefore scale that globally. It means you don't have to choose between, do you take care of the rich or the poor patient? It means you have to do both. Not only can you not afford to exclude one or the other, but also ethically, it's not permissible, but also finally healthcare means our duty to care doesn't allow us to prioritize one over the other. And therefore, that's where I think the promise of a lot of these kind of methodologies arise from, that equity is not an afterthought. It's the first thought. How do I care for the patient regardless of their need?
So how do I care about the patient regardless of the need? You care for the wealthy and you care for everyone else. Just moving, shifting a little bit towards data privacy, how do you navigate the balance between data privacy and the utility of AI in healthcare? We've had different guests come in and talk to us that these LLMs are scraping patient data, and the patients need to have a stake in, let's say, discovery that comes through. So that's one question, and then I will have another question based on something you said about the long life cycle of drugs. But talk to us a little bit about data privacy in AI healthcare.
Excellent question. I think it's a ethically strategic, but also a technically practical question. So from the ethically strategic angle, that's because the global supply chains to even produce this tech is so complex. I mean, you're spanning multiple countries, multiple companies, and multiple sectors to be able to achieve the kind of tech. You have to play nice in the sandbox globally to make this stuff work. The freer the exchange of ideas and innovation and people, the better technology you're going to get from it. That's also the more profitable. And so therefore, the economics requires also the political stability spanning all these supply chains and these sectors to be able to achieve this. So from a strategic level, we need to be able to make sure that it works for people. And therefore, one of this, it seems principal, understandable public concerns of this is, how do I make sure not only does the algorithm work, but is it built in a way that I'm not worried about the security of my privacy and my data? Very fair question. Like in medicine, you don't want to give a medicine that's going to hurt more than it helps. And so from a strategic and ethical standpoint, we see a lot of promise in what I've tried to do in my work as well, in particular with the computational ethics, or how do you do ethics based upon what the empirical results inform for you, is to try to be able to build in, therefore, those ethical safeguards into the R&D process from the very beginning at a structural and strategic level, but also from a technical level. It allows us, therefore, when we're asking the right questions, when you frame the problem well from the initial standpoint, that strategic empathy, as it's described, what does the end user, the end patients, the community you're trying to serve need? And therefore, you reverse engineer the products and services from an AI standpoint in the car to get you to that point, whether it be healthcare, whether it be e-commerce, et cetera. So when you frame and put ethical safeguards on the problem well in the first point, then you can give the technical, practical solutions that are needed such that you don't have to worry when you get a product that works technically, whether people are going to trust it at all. So that's where we're coming in, for instance, with things like swarm learning and federated learning models, where, as you may be familiar with in your listeners, you have the ability where we used to just say, we're going to take a bunch of results from patients' charts. We're going to put it into a big spreadsheet and we're going to analyze results. We're going to spit it out. But not only is that slow and inefficient, but also by the time you go to treat the patient, that patient is long gone, as is the need of the patient. So then multiple evolutions of this, and AI is helping with this, good, ethically strategic, and structurally sound AI is able to help deliver better results to patients that still maintains and optimizes societal trust and reliability of this. So for instance, with swarm learning and different techniques that are coming out like it, we're better able to be able to say, if you have, for instance, three different hospitals in three different parts of the world, then how can you keep not only your data locally, rather than having to put it together and send it to somewhere overseas, and therefore the concerns about the security of that data transfer, how you keep it anonymized, et cetera, and also the concerns about essentially the post-colonial impacts of that. It brings up very painful memories, understandably, for many parts of the world where, like, we extracted minerals in the 1700s and 1800s from one part of the world, shipped them to another part of the world where they used them to consumer goods. Similarly, you can argue that the digital imperialism of a lot of the current models, you can't just take data from one part of the world and train AI somewhere else to benefit populations elsewhere. So what we're seeing is that co-design global local model developed, so where you keep the data locally, but also you keep the AI locally. But importantly, you're able to have the AI that, through appropriate strategic and ethical safeguards, are able to learn from the data and AI from all the other sites. So therefore, everyone learns together, but you don't lose the security or the locality of your data or your individual communities who benefit from it. And so therefore, those exciting technical evolutions and innovations I propose at least are accelerated by, and in many cases come from, first asking the right questions. How do you maintain the trust and the relevance of this for the user, for the patient, and therefore you reverse engineer your tech to be able to do so?
So reverse engineer the tech. Dominic, in healthcare for data privacy, we have HIPAA. Do you think as AI becomes, and they say healthcare has got the most promise for AI, but we've had many guests, many members of Congress, et cetera, who said the promise of AI in healthcare is just incredible. Do you think we need a specific legislation, whether it is for privacy or security or equity or any of those specific to AI in healthcare?
Yes and no. This is where it gets back to that earlier question I thought you also brought up that was very insightful. How do you make sure those that have power use it wisely, justly, and effectively? And how can populations as well, empowered with the knowledge and tools to also co-design and co-develop this well at the same time? So it's not a question of the populations versus the powers or vice versa. So I think this is an excellent practical or regulatory implication of that earlier question. So there's, I think, a very helpful analysis done a little while back on the Brussels effect, as it was coined, I believe, by an NYU professor about that importance of the competing regulatory frameworks. And this is only heating up in the data and the AI world. I mentioned earlier about the arguably the rivalry of the regulatory regimes of the EU, the US, and China. If you have more of a respectively rights-driven versus business-driven versus state-driven regulatory approach. And so the challenge is, if that's where most of the tech is going, then by default, most of the AI and the data governance models globally are therefore going to follow from there. So if you have the US that appears to have a largely shifted a lot of the onus on companies to self-regulate, and that's a simplification, but generally, I think we can argue that. And in China, they're more of a state-driven. The challenge, though, is that there's, I think we can argue, maybe stronger, maybe barriers or hurdles between their internal markets and elsewhere. So it's difficult to have these three competing regulatory frameworks talk to each other, let alone standardize so that corporations can make a product for one company or one market, like the EU being the largest single market, that's not going to conflict with regulatory requirements, for instance, in the US, China, and the global South. So the Brussels effect, therefore, we are seeing that, as you probably know, that effect where you have more of the stringent human rights-based approaches to say that some tech just can never be done. It's going to hurt people more than it's going to help them. Some tech we need to be more cautious with, and therefore some tech we don't have to be cautious much at all with. So therefore you have a risk stratification approach to try to simplify regulations such that it's the minimum necessary to put appropriate safeguards in place to optimize the individual well-being and individual well-being at global scale. So you have humanity's well-being, not just the local populations and the local patients. And therefore, you do see that leading role practically of the Brussels effect, where you see, for instance, the EU AI Act, where companies in the US and China are already building into that compliance by design to their products, anticipating challenges down the road if they don't do so with the largest single market in the EU. And therefore, though, that kind of standardization or self-standardization of compliance by design does seem that we're having that essentially the Brussels effect propagating throughout the rest of the world. And therefore, the question becomes, well, we still can't just delegate this to market forces. We still just can't say, well, let someone else deal with our own regulation, particularly because what happens if EU regulation doesn't appropriately reflect the political economic realities and the cultural identity of a population on the other side of the planet? So therefore, we are seeing promising advances, for instance, with the United Nations General Assembly or Advisory Board on AI, the UNESCO boards, a lot of the big healthcare organizations and global associations all starting the own process of self-discussion of these things. And though it has been critiqued on that concept of principle proliferation, where everyone's just putting out their own AI guidelines and standards, and we see, for instance, only, I believe, as it currently stands right now, less than 16% of healthcare organizations in the US alone have actual AI policies. But the substance of it is questionable, and how you apply it or enforce it is even more so. So we are seeing promising effects that if I go back to the concept of the centralization and the decentralization of AI, or the top-down and bottom-up approach, I think it's a good thing when people are empowered with knowledge. I think it's a good thing when we use that knowledge, even if it's messy, in the public debate on what do we do together to reach consensus that we then operationalize in regulations, standards, norms, and laws. So though you can argue the merits or the lack thereof, for instance, of just releasing ChatGPT, and therefore all these generative AI algorithms that are coming out, a lot of questions, if it's right, is it not? Is it doing more harm than good? Appropriate questions, but you still have essentially decentralized organic regulation at a population level. People are already helping to identify the problems that it would have taken a lot longer should you have developed this in isolation away from populations. So you just can't release tech, though, without any safeguards. But there is a role to play, I think, in that, to your point on regulation, the self-regulation of populations and public discourse as a consensus emerges, as people interact with as much of the ethically safe or guardrail-based tech as possible. So populations can help identify collectively, here are the concerns that we have locally and globally, at the same time that you have a proliferation of these ethical conventions and regulations and norms and standards, because we are seeing a standardization gradually developing based on a gradual global consensus on what is the appropriate, agile, adaptive, and still accountable and responsible regulatory global regime on this. Long story short, the people with power need to ask these tough questions. The people without it need to be able to say what they need. And I think together, we will be able to converge our various power dimensions into a way that is a more just, equitable, and effective world on this.
So the people with power need to ask, and the people without the power need to raise these issues, Dominic. Dominic, just briefly, what do you think is the importance of interdisciplinary collaboration in advancing AI-driven healthcare solutions? You've talked about global collaborations. What about some interdisciplinary collaboration?
I think there is no AI without collaboration. And so I'm a physician, but my other world, in between patients, I have to do the data science, actually devise and deploy the algorithms. But also as an ethicist, with that hat on, I have to think about what's responsible as well, and how do you practically put policies in place that can implement these kind of innovations you develop. So in brief, the co-design model of AI, I really believe in, where you have to, at the very beginning, not after the fact, but in the very beginning, you have patients, community members, healthcare professionals, data scientists, policymakers, and leaders and government officials as well, all at the table at the same time, where you're trying to ask the questions, what do people need? How can we do it responsibly and affordably? And how can we continue to scale it? And you do see promising advances at a concrete level. For instance, like noted earlier with Mayo Clinic's platform, with Cleveland Clinic and a few other organizations, that is part of a smart business strategy of enterprise-wide or mature AI that is not just in certain projects, but you try to put AI throughout the entire organization responsibly. At the same time, it takes a mature interdisciplinary strategy, where the mature strategy says that you're not just going to only listen to a patient's heart when you walk up to the patient as a physician. You're also going to be thinking, how can I apply the probability of treatment A working better than treatment B? But also ethically, how do I do so in a way that's responsible for the patient's needs? So as a provider, you already think across all these different disciplines. So I think our AI strategy has to reflect that, not just our business models.
So AI strategy should reflect interdisciplinary models across the board. Dominic, finally, I mean, I have so many other things to talk about, but you actually have people to take care of. So finally, what message would you like to leave our listeners with about the future of AI in shaping a more equitable and healthier world?
Ooh, excellent question. Please keep doing what you're doing. From your very influential platform to that of your listeners, we just need people to care. We just need people to care about better health for them, their families, their communities, and the global human family. And therefore, doing that, the natural opportunities to take advantage of in people's respective expertise and domains will come to light. So I think the great insights of AI is that it's not just the power people that are driving it, it's all of us. So if we want a better world, AI will help us get there. And so therefore, we just need people to keep doing what they can at a local level to make what's around them better, and therefore at scale, so will the rest of the world.
So people keep doing what they are, ask questions, and get engaged is what Dominic's parting words are for our listeners. Thank you for tuning into this episode of Regulating AI. We extend our deep gratitude to Dominique for sharing his invaluable insights into the ethical dimensions of AI in healthcare and beyond. As we continue to navigate the complexities of regulating AI, let's keep these conversations alive and inclusive, ensuring that our regulatory frameworks reflect the diverse perspectives and priorities of our global community. Stay tuned for more thought-provoking discussions and intersections of AI ethics and regulations. Dominique, thank you again. Really, this has been a very, very insightful conversation. I've learned a lot. I'm sure our listeners have learned a lot. Would love to have you because there are at least 30 questions I had more, but thank you again so much. And this is Sanjay Puri signing off. And you can see about Dominique. He's got 4 books in our show notes. So thank you, Dominique. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for tuning in to the Regulating AI Innovate Responsibly podcast. You'll find links in the show notes to any resources mentioned on the show. If you're enjoying our podcast, please subscribe so you'll never miss an episode and leave us a 5-star review.